Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is Truth Finder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give Truth Finder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time. Well, it started out as an intriguing documentary project that looked into a self-styled exorcist priest in Argentina. Well, by the time this filmmaker reached his climactic end of this production, our guest found himself locked in a room with a sinister priest that he was facing and a never-ending verbal attack that got so ugly that the journalist thought he might even be killed. Let's talk Cults Among Us. Talking with Andrew Gold, a journalist documentary maker for HBO and the BBC. And he also is the host of the podcast On the Edge with Andrew Gold. Now, I always think this is so amazing, Andrew, but you speak five languages. And you go out every single day of your life now documenting the world's strangest and most controversial people in the world. Your specialty, by everything I've been able to find, is cult thinking, cognitive bias, politics, true crime, and the paranormal. I mean, you are the perfect guest for Profiling Evil. So welcome, and thanks so much for taking time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. You know, when I came across your channel, I thought immediately, oh, I've got to get on here. This is great. Such a perfect fit for the two of us, isn't it? It's really match made in heaven.
Well, it would have been so fun, too, as I was in Europe in the last month. I've been over there, and if we'd have just thought ahead, it would have been so easy to stop into the UK and actually do this live. It would have been a blast to do it side by side rather than here. But you're calling in from the UK tonight. And I really appreciate you taking time. And I want to start off by talking about your award-winning investigation that you did for the BBC. It was titled Exorcism, The Battle for Young Minds. And it focused on a priest who was performing exorcisms, I guess still is today, on psychiatric patients. Would you kind of just walk us through that? Tell us a little bit about the film. And I think most importantly, why you chose to do it on this particular individual?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that he is still active today, unfortunately, because I sort of hoped that the expose might make a bit more of a dent in Argentina where he's active, and it doesn't seem to have done. It's more popular and well-known in the UK where, you know, he doesn't even speak English and most of his followers don't. But yeah, so I was living in Argentina. I got a bit obsessed in my 20s, which was now a few years ago, I'm afraid to say, my 20s. But I was a bit obsessed with languages, and I moved around a lot, and I liked documenting different kinds of people on the edge of society, on the fringes, and trying to work out why one person's brain and mind is different to my own. And while living in Argentina, this exorcist kept popping up on the TV, on the radio, and he was really quite famous. And I know in the States, you guys have some of these, you have so many TV channels. So some of them are these like religious ones with preachers and stuff like that. That's something I hadn't been used to in the UK. So to see that was quite startling for me in Argentina. And then to see this guy not just being on those channels, but he was sort of penetrating the mainstream channels. He would be on the big talk shows of the day, advising people about, you know, what they should do on Halloween, you know, how many pumpkins to ward off the devil and all these kinds of things, and selling sort of oils to people that would ward off breast cancer, things like that. So it actually started to annoy me. And I said to my girlfriend who's from there and her family are from there in Argentina, I would turn to her and say, God, I'd love to do something with this guy, you know, maybe expose him, but also get to grips with the whole thing. I've never been next to an exorcism. So it was just a case of getting in touch with him. I got in touch with the BBC. The BBC were not interested. They liked the idea, but it was all going to be in Spanish. So they were just like, and it didn't quite happen. But meanwhile, I had him messaging me afterwards, he's using quite sort of cultish and godly words, you know, when will thou be, it's like that kind of thing, but in Spanish. And I was like, you know what, we're just going to do it anyway. So went and filmed it with my friend David, who's a director, and had to sell it later to the BBC. So that's what got me into it.
You know, that actually is not only gutsy, but it tells me a little bit about you as an individual, because you were invested 100% into this story, knowing that there wasn't a dollar waiting for you, that you actually had to go and do it because it was driving you from the inside. So it makes me kind of want to ask, of course, you know, I mean, profiling is my business, so I'm digging a little into your own psyche here, but tell me, this idea of digging into the dark side, were you raised in a family of faith? Was it something that was frightening to you, at the same time a little bit challenging or exciting?
Yeah, absolutely. So my family was Jewish. Being Jewish in the UK is a little bit different to US. I'm still watching all the reruns of Seinfeld, for example, and I feel like the way Seinfeld has sort of made an impact on the culture in the US, people know Yiddish words and things like that. Most people in the UK that I meet have never met a Jewish person before. They expect horns, you know, that kind of thing. So it was sort of being outside of the culture in a sense, and still being just, you know, a white normal guy. But the difference was, on Sundays, I had to learn Hebrew. I had to go to like the Sunday school to learn Hebrew, which a lot of Jewish people do, even quite secular families. And mine was relatively secular. And it's a strange thing to look back on and go like, God, I was sitting there. And maybe that inspired future language learning. But I'm sitting there looking at these sort of hieroglyphics, you know, of Hebrew. I never learned what the words mean, because that's not what's important. What's important is that when you're 13, you can get up and do your bar mitzvah and you can read out all this stuff. So I still have it in my head. All this mad stuff. I was an atheist by the time I was about 11, but I knew that at 13 I would get presents and money and stuff if I did this bar mitzvah. So that was what was important to me and a lot of other kids, I think. So I think that probably had some sort of, okay, it felt a bit culty sometimes. There was a lot of respect, for example, for like these rabbis. There was a lot of like, the rabbis sometimes seemed quite arrogant to me. They're not all like that. Some of them are lovely. And people would shush me if I was talking and say, shh, have some respect, the rabbi's talking. And I just thought, but why? I want to question this guy. What's so good about him? He seems to believe all this stuff, which is fine. And I want people listening who have faith and stuff, and, you know, I'm not judging them at all. I think it's important, you know, people have their religious beliefs and stuff like that. So I'm not that guy who's criticizing other people's beliefs. It just wasn't for me. So there was that. And then I think, on an ideological, political level, when you're Jewish, you become quite sensitive to conspiracy theorists, which is another type of religion. It's like an atheistic religion. It's still a religious. And on the left and the right, there are a lot of these sort of conspiracy theories about Jews ruling the world, things like that. So I grew up very, very sensitive to both the religious non-questioning side, which was the rabbi, don't question him, don't just everybody respect him, and also the political side of, you know, the conspiracy theories of the mythology that people can be swept up in. And so those were two things I was very wary of growing up.
I'm going to ask you a little bit of a personal question. So if you'd have told your mother that you were going to go and try to interview an exorcist, what would she have said?
Oh, she would find it funny, I suppose. I think scared on my behalf. I mean, my parents were really, I don't want to give the impression I grew up in any kind of cult. It was really, everything was exactly the same as it would be for like a non-religious family, except Sundays I had to go to this place. We never spoke about God at home, anything like that. But sometimes there were prayers once every few months for some sort of holy holiday or something. No one knew what they meant. No one cared. You just do it before dinner. So it was very relaxed in that sense. And then my school I went to was a Christian school, a private school. So every morning I would be doing the Our Father who art in heaven and all that Christian stuff. And then on Sundays going to do the Hebrew stuff, which was all mad. But my mom, I think, yeah, she's just very supportive and finds it quite funny. she loved that I was going out and doing that. And when it did finally come out, it came out on the BBC. It was a big deal for me, that, because I'd done some shorter documentaries for HBO, which I didn't even get to see, because if you're not in America, you can't watch them. But back in the UK, I'm there with my mum. I went back from Argentina and we sat there and we watched, we kept refreshing on YouTube and seeing the numbers go up because the BBC had this, you know, subscribership that I don't, it's just like a different level to what I was used to. And we were just so excited. So she was just very supportive and excited for me.
Well, I mean, this thing went off the charts and I want to talk a little bit about that as we go through this, but just a little bit more about the fact that you had this innate sense of respect and that you've got to pay a little bit of respect to a clergyman, that they deserve that by virtue of who they are and what they do. But all of a sudden you're there. And you know what? I know there are a lot of different opinions. And it's interesting when you say that you're now atheist. I recently have been making some comments about John Krakauer's book on the Under the Banner of Heaven, where he talks about a couple of brothers who believed they were operating in the name of God, and they ended up executing their sister-in-law and her baby. And I found it so intriguing because he was so critical of those of faith. And I found that a really difficult thing for someone who declares that they're atheist to be able to judge someone in that way when they're such polar opposites. But I didn't feel at all that there was any disrespect that you had throughout that entire film. And I just really appreciated it. But here's the question. In your opinion, after going through what you saw, does exorcism work?
That was what was really interesting for me as well, because you don't want to go into a film with your preconceptions, and that's what journalists do. And there is a little bit, I could talk for hours about that. There is way too much activism in journalism. There's way too much people going in with their views and saying, this is how it is. I don't believe in spirituality and all that stuff, but I wanted to go in and say, okay, what can I find that is going to change my mind in some way? Because otherwise I've not gone on any kind of journey. And that's the whole point of this. So I really didn't like the priest. I don't believe in the paranormal, but I did see people get over the kinds of illnesses that they had, which was fascinating for me.
Well, folks, we're talking to Andrew Gold, a journalist and a man who's created a number of documentaries, one that has played specifically on the BBC titled Exorcism, The Battle for Young Minds. He's also had work on HBO. I mean, this is the real deal here. And I really appreciate what you were saying there, Andrew, because, you know, I think of the placebo effect and I think of other kinds of things. Sometimes I think if I could just get some fresh air, I'm going to feel a lot better. And I get outside and you know what? I feel a lot better. But why do you think this stuff is working?
Oh, there's some great literature on it. There's a book called The Expectation Effect that came out last year by a guy called David Robson, who I'm a big fan of, a science writer, came on my podcast a couple of times now to talk about this kind of stuff. And the way placebo works is unbelievable. And again, I don't know all the facts, and I should remember this for when I talk about it, but there was a doctor that he speaks about in his book that he writes about from, I guess, World War, I'm going to say one, who did realize that he could just like, he didn't have to use, he didn't have to numb anesthesia. He didn't have to use any anesthetic or anything like that on people in the war because they were so thrilled that they'd survived the war or gotten, you know, the adrenaline and that kind of thing, that they didn't feel any pain. They even declined painkillers. And that showed this doctor, I wish I could remember his name, but it showed him that, wow, the mind is this really powerful, amazing tool. It can really change how you feel. It can change how we feel about side effects. So the placebo effect is really remarkable. And there's been, for example, there's been some evidence like of physiological differences. If you give somebody with Parkinson's a sugar pill, then the brain actually produces different chemicals that help deal with the symptoms of Parkinson's. They have actual physical evidence of that. So it's really the most incredible thing. And it's like your body is sort of preparing, it's feeling as though it's getting better. And there's loads of evidence about, for example, you could live longer as well. People who are happier in later life, what you said about getting some fresh air as well, you feel a bit better, you breathe a bit better, you feel good. That is real science, and they're learning more and more about it. And I think that's what I witnessed with the exorcisms.
Did you learn any lessons in, what some may call mind manipulation, others may call spiritual intervention. But did you learn any lessons as far as some of those keywords that people use, or emotions, or even a building of emotion? Now, you see it often, like in, you'll see it in some Christian faiths where they start out kind of very quiet and monotone, and it starts to build. And before long, I mean, they're almost yelling, and people are yelling hallelujah. You see this fervor grow. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know your stuff, because that's exactly how it went down. And it surprised me. So the first time we showed an exorcism, or we filmed it, and I was there, I took part in it, and I was holding the bells and things like that, which are supposed to ward off the devil or whatever. And it was so intense, and it was so horrible to watch, even though I didn't believe in exorcism and all that stuff and all the paranormal stuff, that after that, we decided, I'm not going to take part in this anymore, because this is actually very serious. Whatever you believe in, this is a 17-year-old girl, or whoever it might be, who's in a very, very vulnerable position right now, who's having what I believe is a mental breakdown, what others might see as some sort of religious thing, whatever it is, it's terrifying. But the three times I think it was that we did exorcisms, as you say, it started very, very slowly. And in the documentary, we've got like an hour for the whole, or 40 minutes, I think it is, the whole documentary. So you condense every part. So each exorcism is like a minute or two of the film. But we were there for an hour and a half each time. So for the first half an hour, I'm standing over this woman who's just not reacting and is just sort of on the floor. And I genuinely thought, oh God, this is embarrassing for the exorcist, because he's got us all down here. We've got the cameras. He's all excited and nothing's going to happen. So I was sort of looking at my director behind the camera, just going like, oh bloody hell, this is awkward. Then the repetition, the power of God compels you, the burning, lots of fire and brimstone, lots of these kinds of things. You know, around the church, the exorcist has got a lot of posters of the film The Exorcist and his face superimposed over the protagonist. So yeah, really crazy. And he's got the music as well from The Exorcist, Tubular Bells, that plays at his mass. But there are like 10,000 people like out into the streets, like bowing down to him. And he's got, dun, 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 dun. I don't want to get you a copy. I can't even do it. I'm so tone deaf right now, but I don't want to get you a copyright.
Yeah, thank goodness you're so bad at tones that we'll never get hit on a copyright.
Dun, 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 dun. I can't do it. But so he really obviously believed in himself, and he's using a lot of images of the movies that, even if you haven't seen The Exorcist, you've seen the Simpsons version or the other version, or you've seen people talk about it, or you've seen other things that are derivative of The Exorcist. So you know how you're supposed to react. I think you go into a bit of a trance. He's repeating and repeating and repeating. He's squirting water in her face, this girl on the floor, getting very aggressive, very pushy and shovey. And when you listen to how hypnotists like Derren Brown, when they talk about what they do, you know, there is that suggestion that there is apparently this feeling of, God, I'm letting everyone down if I don't do the thing that they want me to do right now. And I'm thinking of this girl, Candela, who was 17 years old, and she just went mad. And it was scary because she was laughing. She was putting on demonic voices, just, she's mine, she was saying. And I'm standing there just terrified. Even though I don't believe in paranormal stuff, I'm just thinking, this is terrifying to watch. Her mum is here. Her dad is waiting outside, which to me felt a little bit like a pregnancy. It felt like I was witnessing a birth, and it is the same thing of expelling something from her. The dad is made to wait outside, like an old-fashioned pregnancy. The mum is sort of there watching, very concerned. And you've got all this like staff trying to help and running around and getting towels and draping things everywhere. It felt like that kind of thing, and it felt like I shouldn't be here for this. Nobody should, and there should be some licensed doctors here, because this is a girl, I should say, by the way, at 17 years old, who has been cutting her wrists, who is suicidal, has got bulimia and all sorts of psychological difficulties. And it just felt like, what is she doing here? This isn't right.
You know, even if you don't believe it, the emotion is so captivating of what's going on. Now, I'm thinking about, I always think of things from a predatory standpoint, and I'm thinking of, you know, there are the producers, and then there are the actors in a play. And this priest is the producer of this event that's going on. How smart that was of him to get you involved.
Why is that? Why?
You know, if I can get you to buy off on this, what happens to your messaging in your documentary? If I can get you to believe this, what happens to the messaging in your documentary? Was it the first time he invited a journalist to watch this?
I think he had invited Agence France-Presse, AFP, who are like a more of a press, you know, and so they took some videos. They were there at the same time as us. He's very into his social media. So I shouldn't really publicize him, but who cares? I think it's something like Luteranos Charismaticos or something like that. Charismatic Lutherans. He's a Lutheran technically, even though what he's doing draws from a lot of Catholicism, and Argentina's a Catholic country. But he's really into the video stuff, you know, the video evangelist stuff. There's so much of that now online. They use that to spread their message. So he's quite tech savvy. But yeah, getting me involved, you're right. Yeah, it gets me. I became an accomplice in many senses. At the same time, it's something that I often volunteer for myself. I don't remember if I volunteered or he asked me now, but it's something I often want to get involved because that's the fun of it in a sense. And that was where I guess I got it wrong as well. The thing about exorcism in particular, more than any other cultish practice, for some reason it seems funny. And I found it funny. And I think most people do. If you talk about an exorcist, you maybe watch some short videos on Vice Media or whatever it might be on YouTube. And they go to the country and they speak to some person and they look completely crazy. And we all sort of laugh at home. What are these crazy people having? They're screaming like idiots. What a bunch of idiots. And I think that's why it was so important for me to speak Spanish, to be able to be integrated in the culture. And then I was able to see these people not as cartoon characters on YouTube as I had previously done, I must admit, but as real 3D people. So then to see that happening to real people with real vulnerabilities and real fear and them not knowing what to do with their daughter is suicidal, and this is all going on in front of me, it just like it put everything like up 10 times. It was just like, wow. It was made it more real.
Well, and I think it's important to acknowledge the fact that if this priest today is less than forthcoming and doing this more as a business and for whatever, I have a hard time believing that that's how it started out, that it started out with the right intentions and that things kind of cankered over time. And we're going to learn a lot more about this, so I hope I'm not speaking out of turn. But folks, I'm speaking with Andrew Gold, a journalist, a documentary filmmaker for HBO and the BBC, and the podcast host of On the Edge with Andrew Gold. Make sure you're going to your favorite podcast platform and subscribing. I know I already have, and you don't want to miss out on listening to this guy talk about other kinds of topics with all of his amazing guests. Now, we're talking about today his award-winning documentary on exorcisms. And this priest in Argentina who allowed Andrew to witness how he does it and to participate in it. In a minute, you're going to hear the bone-chilling experience that Andrew had when this demon-casting priest actually had Andrew participating. And then, of course, this thing ramps up. But I want to stop for just a second, Andrew, and take care of a little selfish business and talk about our podcast here at Profiling Evil, which explores cults and cult mentality and behaviors. And I want to pause just long enough to remind people about my book, Deceived, an investigative memoir of the Zion Society cult. Now, Deceived explores cult behaviors and cult dynamics, just like those that we're talking about. But the book Deceived chronicles my investigation and ultimate takedown of a religious cult that committed more than 4,000 rapes and sexual assaults against children and adult women before I was fortunate enough to lead a team of more than 60 police officers as we raided that compound one early morning. In all, we arrested and convicted 12 people. There should have been more, but some things don't work out. The real story, though, is about how we helped these 32 child survivors, but most importantly, how they rose above the abuse. The book explores cult recruiting tactics and how seemingly intelligent people can be convinced to commit crimes. You can get signed hardbound copies of Deceived at Profiling Evil, or you can get paperback and ebook versions of the book on Amazon. But now let's return to Andrew Gold.
So, well, Andrew, I should just say, I don't want to interrupt you, but that sounds fantastic. And obviously, you're coming on my show as well. I want to read that book. I saw you on Dr. Phil, and I got a bit of a lump in my throat watching it. What a fantastic story.
Oh, that's so kind to say. And yeah, kudos to Dr. Phil, who has become a good friend. But that guy surprised me with that one. He snuck those kids in. I hadn't seen him in 30 years. And of course, you saw how I reacted. The last time I saw them was when they were child victims. And now they're the adult, beautiful women that they are. And it was just a remarkable experience. But thank you. And I do look forward to coming on your show soon.
It's going to be great. I'm really excited for that.
Well, so remind everybody of who this priest is and how you came to know about him and how you got him to allow you to come and participate.
Yeah, so his name is actually Padre Manuel Acuña. I was living in Argentina. He is all over the TV, all over the radio, advising quite mainstream TV specialists and mainstream people, even secular people, about how they should prepare for Halloween or Christmas or the Easter Bunny or whatever it might be, and giving out advice about, you know, very paranormal things, which, you know, really are from a few hundred years ago. It's not the kind of thing we should be learning about today on the TV. He is, I should add as well, and this is maybe not so journalistic to say, it's not very professional to say, but I just found him very smarmy. He has smarm about him and an arrogance. And perhaps that did remind me of some of the sort of rabbis and other religious leaders I knew growing up. There was an arrogance and a posture he had that made me go, you know what, I've got to go and investigate him. At the back of my mind, I was perhaps thinking, I've got to go and expose him. He's up to something. There was something. But then you're trying to fight that as a journalist all the time. You go, no, 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 you've got to go in and be objective and see what happens. But there was part of me going, yeah, you bad guy, there's something you're hiding here.
Isn't that something? And when you think about the God that you grew up learning about, whether you believe in him today or not, the behavior that we see in some of these ecclesiastic leaders is not that humble, loving, caring soul that you would envision God to be like. And we, I think we like to make in religion God this terrifying soul that we need to be worried about instead of someone who just wants us to be successful.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, we respond to fear, don't we? And it's not just ecclesiastical people, it's the press. You know, the press put out stuff that's scary. We read it. I had a guy on the podcast called Paul Bloom, a professor at Yale at the time, who has this, he writes about how we enjoy suffering to an extent. I mean, you on a small level, it might be things like why we might like spicy food or why we like hot baths. And on a macro level, we do like to suffer to an extent. We like to self-flagellate a little bit. And one of the reasons for that is because we like to watch sort of horror movies and things. And the reason that our brains apparently have evolved to be really engrossed by these ideas of fire and brimstone and stuff is because our brains see that as a practice run. So it's the same reason we might watch zombie movies. You watch an apocalypse movie. We watch them because our brain is saying to us, hey, watch this. This is important information. This might happen. Obviously not actually zombies, but some sort of apocalypse could happen. And you've got to be aware. You've got to be ready for that. I think there's a lot of that in the scary side of religion. And a lot of religions don't preach that scary side. But those that do have a real grasp on their followers because we're engrossed. We're sort of titillated. We're watching it because our brains are doing that thing like we do with horror movies of going like, watch this, watch what he says, because you might have to prepare for whatever this bad, scary stuff is.
Yeah, that is so insightful because, you know, I spent much of my career talking to serial killers and serial sexual predators. And the one thing that I always scratched my head at in the early days, not any longer, was that more women were intrigued by serial killers than men. And it took me a while to figure out. It was the fear of being victimized. It was, in some cases, the mothering instinct to somehow correct behavior, but mostly it was trying to understand. And what you're saying, it makes a whole lot of sense. And you've talked about this just a little bit, but I want you to maybe touch on it just a little more, maybe from A to Z. But this guy actually had you participating in an exorcism. So kind of walk through what happened and what it was like to perform one.
Yeah, okay. And I want to touch on what you just said, because that's fascinating that women are more interested in that stuff. And again, like, imagine if they didn't have that sort of, I think it's a dopamine injection in the brain that comes from watching this stuff. Imagine if they didn't evolve to have that and never ever showed interest in true crime podcasts and news and stuff like that. They'd be totally unprepared for when a guy did come along and took them away or did whatever they do to, they would be totally, totally unprepared. They would never see it coming. So it's a really, really good like security measure that they are. And that's evolutionary.
You're absolutely right. In fact, my wife, I've listened to her several times say to especially men, when you walk out to a parking lot at 10 o'clock at night from the mall, what are your thoughts? And guys are like, I'm wondering if I'm going to grab a burger on the way home or not. And their thoughts are, where's the lighting? Who are the people out here? Are my keys in my hand? Do I have a way to escape from this location? They're pre-programmed to think and be prepared. And it really is a difference in not only gender, but in a mindset.
Yeah, yeah. And so I find that stuff fascinating. I love talking to these philosopher guys. There's the, you know, guys and women, or very, they're so smart, and they're so, I love having the evolutionary stuff explained to me in words that I, a layperson or a journalist, can understand and go, ah, that explains why women are so interested in true crime, and why men and women are so interested in true crime and horror movies and the fire and brimstone element of religion, because it prepares us for whatever it might be. Now, yes, taking part in the exorcism, again, it is partly me. And look, there's a cheeky side to my journalism as well, but maybe a bit less as I get older. But in my 20s, there was a lot of that cheeky rascal thing. And a lot of the questions I ask him at the beginning are, do you have the expression tongue in cheek in the States?
We do.
Ah, good, good. My dad told me
this probably story. Stole it from you when we fled.
Quite possibly. If it's a couple hundred years old, the expression, then possibly. My dad, he tells me this story about how he remembers reading something about Mick Jagger from the Rolling Stones being quite tongue-in-cheek when he was a kid. He read this. And my dad took that to mean he actually put his tongue in his cheek. So my dad, for a few weeks, sort of, he was like 12, he walked around sort of tongue in his cheek a little bit, because he thought that was like the Rolling Stones would do. But yes, I very, very tongue in cheek at the beginning. So I'm asking him questions about, you know, ridiculous things like vampires, and do you believe in vampires? Do you believe it? And he's just completely stone faced, and he's going, yes, 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 yes. So there is the joke making a little bit, and that's what I was touching on before. I thought that this was going to be funny, and very quickly realized it wasn't. It might have even been my suggestion to take part in the exorcism, because I thought it was silly. And I thought I would go around. So he said, okay, you can hold the bells. I sort of forgot about that until the time of the exorcism, by which point I'm getting nervous. I'm standing over this 17-year-old girl. She's starting to shake a bit. I'm going, what are we doing here? Is this a good idea? The BBC might not even buy this documentary. I'm just a guy in the middle of the suburbs of Buenos Aires standing over a young girl. What am I doing? And then he suddenly goes like, you know, he beckons to me. And I'm like, oh, what? And he passes me these bells, and he's shouting over all the screaming, because his other priests are on the floor going, you know, the power of God compels you, the power of the, and he's shouting over me, these will ward off the devil. And I'm like, okay. And he's like, you've got to ring them over her head. So I go and sort of stand over her head, and I'm ringing these bells. my director, David, who, again, he's David's a friend of mine. I've known him since university. We were together at university. He's a really close friend of mine. And it so happens that he's an absolute whiz with cameras and stuff. He's now working professionally as a director, but this was his first long form project. And we thought, let's do this. So we're looking at each other a bit like, what have I gotten into here? Just screams are echoing out through the church hall, through the nave of the church. Everyone's panicking. And a lot of people in the church really, really genuinely believe they are fighting Satan in the church. And maybe some, you know, I don't know how much all of them believe. Maybe some of them don't really believe that. But at least some people do, especially the girl right below me, this 17-year-old girl. She does believe this. And that's really scary for me. So I felt completely out of place. I felt really stupid, inappropriate. As I was saying before, it felt like a pregnancy. It felt like I was in an intimate setting that I wasn't supposed to be in. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a family member. What am I doing here? Ringing bells like an idiot. And she screamed like you can't imagine. And it was an hour of just, well, I'll never forget it. And to be honest, as horrible as it was, that's probably, as a journalist, wanting to experience different things, wanting to learn different languages. I suppose part of me, as much as a lot of me was scared of it, part of me might have enjoyed that. And that's that very thing we were just talking about, which was it was so scary that I felt myself drawn to it for whatever evolutionary reason. I was just in that moment. Very scary.
How much time did you actually spend with this priest before you started to notice that there were some really disturbing character flaws? And then, as you're talking about that, kind of give some of those red flags that began popping up and what was going on in your mind, like, hey, I got to get out of here or whatever.
I think day one, I think this first day, I actually went before we started filming. I went and had a look and I met him and all of that stuff. And I came back to my friend David and I said, because he was living in Buenos Aires with me at the time as well. And I said, yeah, we've got to do this. This guy's nuts. So it was day one. And I think the first thing to give it away was probably the posters on the wall with his face superimposed over that of the protagonist from The Exorcist. That wasn't the only film. I can't remember right now which other ones, but it could, let's say for the sake of argument, it was Superman and a few others. And they're just around the church, his little silly pompous face, really pompous. And as I say, since I was a child, I've hated that sort of pomposity. I've always found that really unappealing. I don't like hierarchies, really. I don't like this guy in charge of everyone. And we saw the way he was speaking to his team then. So the next week I came back with David. We filmed some bits and pieces. I showed David, of course, all the posters, which we found ridiculous. And David got close shots of all of these things. The Exorcist was watching us, Padre Manuel. He's watching us and he's obviously thinking, oh, good, good. They've got the very important posters with my face superimposed. You know, he didn't know we found it funny. So right from the off, it was like, this is an odd guy. But also then I saw the way he talked with his team sometimes and when he didn't think we were watching. And we got some footage sort of behind through the side of a door, a little bit of him sort of, you know, pointing with his finger at people and looking quite aggressive. I saw the way that the rest of his team, his clergy, looked up to him. And there was a mixture of respect and fear. There was fear there. And he was very, very close. This was over, maybe we didn't notice it in the first day. He was very close with somebody called Paola, who was his assistant. And after maybe a week of filming, we were there nearly every day for about 2 months. We went back and forward. We took a train out to the outskirts of Buenos Aires where he was. It's quite a poor area, not much education and things, very different to the center of Buenos Aires, which is very modern and fairly secular. So we're going out there each day. And then Paola, his assistant, told us that her name used to be Laura and she's changed it. And Laura is the exorcist's most famous ever exorcism. It's the videos are all over YouTube, the exorcism of Laura, El Exorcismo de Laura. And we were like, she said she changed her name for whatever reason. I don't know why then she told us that. So then now everybody knows that Paola is Laura and Laura is Paola. But the point was, she had been exorcised by him quite, you know, brutally. It was a really severe, extreme exorcism, and now was his right-hand woman. and it seemed a bit odd. So straight away we were like, okay, we're supposed to be journalists here. Let's look into that. Now her parents were nowhere to be found. They'd both moved to other countries. She's just hanging around in this place. She had been in a psychiatric ward for almost her entire teenage years, her entire adolescence, diagnosed with schizophrenia. So she had all sorts of problems. And we went and met her former psychiatrist. But the thing was, she gave us permission to talk about her medical files. And on the morning we went to the hospital to speak to them, they said that the exorcist had been in touch and that she had withdrawn her permission. So they weren't able to speak about her specifically anymore. So all of this was very controlling, very weird. This psychiatrist was only able to speak sort of vaguely and generally about people with schizophrenia, teenagers. And he said, it's actually surprisingly common how often they will get adolescents with schizophrenia or other psychological conditions who get taken away once they're 17 or 18 by exorcists, shamans, other kinds of religious or magical people. And it's really sad. And there's not much that these doctors can do about it to stop it. So she had been with him for some time. Yeah, go on, sorry.
The cop side of me is just like all my spidey senses are jumping up. What was the age difference between the pastor and this child?
So he's in his mid-50s, and she, when she was exorcised, was 17. I don't know all the details because it was very difficult. The more I pushed in that direction, they got, as you saw by the end of the film, very, very suspicious and very defensive. So I had to constantly hide that was what I was trying to get at. I had to always be like, oh, wow, what an amazing exorcism. And you had one yourself, didn't you? Isn't that fantastic? How old were you when that happened? And she's like, oh, 17. So, and gradually she started to work with the exorcist and she left the psychiatric ward. So I should say, I haven't seen, you know, proof of them having a relationship. But as we'll go on to discuss, I mean, that there's a lot of stuff that's certainly inappropriate at the very, very least.
Yeah. I mean, that those are the red flags, aren't they? You start to see this, what appears to be in a normal circumstance, an inappropriate relationship or an inappropriate attraction to a rescuer of sorts. Continue on. I'm sorry for interrupting you.
No, please do. I always interrupt people on my show. I love it. I never know how to, actually. It's the hardest thing, especially on Zoom. In real life, it's so much easier to do it. And then on Zoom or Riverside or whatever it is, it's like, oh, when can I, you know, I asked someone a question the other day on my podcast and they spoke for, I think, 35 minutes and I couldn't get in. It was too late. Because what do you do? I think you can interrupt in the first 5-10 minutes, but once it's been 30 minutes, I thought if I say something now, they're going to feel really silly. So I just thought, oh, I've just got to just wait.
See, I never worry when I'm with a filmmaker because everything they do is always in short segments because they know they got to work something new in.
That's it. And we know how it all works. And so, yeah, please feel free to interrupt whatever. Just put your hand up, just shout over me. I'm not precious. I don't care. I would prefer that. So Paola, or Laura, her real name is Paola, and he were together all the time. Padre Manuel Acuña, the exorcist, and he and her were together all the time. I started asking some of the other clergy, hey, what's going on with them? And they were like, oh, they're just very, very, very close since the exorcism. And that's all they would tell me. But I started to realize all stuff they don't really tell you, because he wants to talk about his message to God and how he's helping people get over cancer and stuff like that. He doesn't want to talk about things like where he lives. Well, he lives upstairs in the church. That took us quite a few weeks to realize, which I guess looking back, it seems silly. How did we not look into that early on? But and there's nothing wrong with that in itself, by the way, except that she also lived there. And then we're like, oh, okay, because her parents are away in a different country. She's been there since she was 17, and she's living upstairs, sleeping upstairs in the church. It's quite a small church as well, so it's like I don't know what the living arrangement. And again, it's another question where another sort of issue where I couldn't ask because it would show that I was onto them. But all sorts of other things. It just seemed a bit odd between them. And at the end of the film, we started to uncover more sort of Facebook stuff, photos on their public Facebook profile of the two of them off gallivanting around Europe, going on these trips and stuff. And I should say, for an exorcist in the impoverished suburbs of Buenos Aires, even to be able to take a trip to Brazil or something, that's just unaffordable. they were going to like Spain in Europe. They were like hanging around in Italy and Spain and meeting like other exorcists out there. And the two of them were obviously sharing hotels and stuff. So firstly, it's totally inappropriate that, you know, what are they doing, these two people together who lived together in one, you know, the whole thing is a bit fishy. And secondly, where are they getting that much money? Because you're talking about thousands of dollars for the two of them to be able to take these kinds of holidays. And at this point in Argentina, you know, the living wage is like $50 a month. You know, it's like outrageous.
Would individuals, I assume, have to pay to have that exorcism occurred in kind or trade or in dollars themselves? And then I want to ask you another question here.
Hmm. It was very sneaky how he does it. I mean, look, he's a smart guy. These people tend to be. So whenever I asked him that, it was always like, no, we do this for free. This is all free. What it is that the exorcisms, which are sometimes public, sometimes aren't, they're window dressing. And you go and see the exorcism, or you go and have an exorcism, and you're sort of almost exit through the gift shop kind of thing. And the gift shop is just countless little things. And it's honestly, it's literally olive oil in a tiny, tiny cup that will go for like the equivalent of like $30, which for them out there is a lot of money. And they're all just lapping it up. They're spending and spending and spending. So that's how he does it.
So these red flags are coming up, and it doesn't take a lot of imagination to think where that relationship most likely was going. And in the very reality, the appearance alone is as damning as anything else. I mean, this is a clergy member, so the appearance alone is just so detrimental to what he does. But in the end, this thing really bugged me, because you get pulled into a room alone and they throw your camera crew buddy out. You don't have any support. I remember him at one point even chastising you for speaking English as that separation was occurring. And then this pastor does something that was completely unexpected and yet probably was your biggest fear. Why don't you talk through that?
Oh, yeah. So in that, we hadn't been expecting that at all, because I thought I was being quite surreptitious and subtle in my way of trying to find out what he was getting up to. But the thing was, I was asking some of his clergy about his relationship with this Paula assistant. And I think I got overconfident, and it's a lesson I've learned, because they seemed a little bit disillusioned, some of them. They'd been scolded by him. They'd also been pushed aside, so Paula took pride of place. And I saw the sort of hierarchical dynamics going on there and thought, okay, this is my in. And so I asked them, and they did sort of reveal a bit like, well, they are together a lot, and some of us are a bit annoyed by that. What I didn't think about, and it's so obvious looking back, was that, you know, once I went away, they went and reported straight to him. You know, he's been asking questions about Paula. And then towards the end of the film, so after we'd been filming for a few weeks, he had invited one night for this big mass or whatever, he invited a journalist at a tabloid newspaper in Argentina who is a friend of his. He reports it's like the biggest sort of tabloid newspaper in Argentina, and they have a whole paranormal section. So there's a particular journalist who comes to see the exorcist all the time, and they sort of have a relationship where, you know, the exorcist tells him a few things. There's a journalist, his name's Marco, he publishes it all or whatever. And he was there because the exorcist was planning to do a multiple exorcism. He wanted to exorcise like 30 people in a room at once, and it was going to be a big news story. So I thought, okay, I'm going to interview this guy, Marco, the journalist, and sort of ask him about it. And at first I thought maybe he finds this all funny and silly, but he didn't. He took it quite seriously. But I spoke to him, just not really about much at all, just, you know, how's the exorcist, how's this Paula girl, it looks like she had this big exorcism and now she's better, all this stuff. And Marco's going, yeah. Anyway, so that was that. It was just a normal interview. And then I go back to wait for this mass to take place. It's a big mass, tens of thousands of people are out there waiting for it. Half of them are falling on the floor with, you know, thinking they're having exorcisms happen to them out of thin air. And Paula then says, Andrew, can you come backstage? So I go backstage with David. David's filming me and he's, you know, following me over. And the Padre Manuel says, Andrew, can you just come into this little room? And I was like, okay, come on, David. And he goes, no, not David, just you. And at that point, I sort of froze a bit, because this was very scary to me. We're out in the middle of nowhere. And of course, like, it's, you know, murders anywhere are relatively rare, you know, and I knew that was very relatively unlikely. But when it does happen, it tends to be people who are completely, you know, these people were crazy. They were unhinged. I was in some sort of mad cult setting out in an area with, you know, very relatively little in terms of police enforcement and sort of no rules. Anything goes here where we were. It was midnight after midnight. No way of even getting home. We hadn't even figured that part out. And we did have with us, me and David, there was a friend of ours, an assistant we took him with. We call him the translator in the documentary because we just didn't know what else to call him in the subtitles. A guy called Demian. But he was like 18 at the time, you know, so he wasn't going to... Look, David's very slight as a person, short and slight. This guy Demian was like 18 or 19, and I've never had a fight in my life. I wouldn't know how to make a fist, you know? So suddenly it went from being this silly exorcism thing with some, of course, serious parts to it, to like, oh, my life's on the line here. I could tell straight away something wasn't right. So we go inside, and the exorcist, he sort of shuffles up to me, and obviously we don't have this on camera, but David's still recording outside. We're just getting like... people, they don't know he's still filming, but people are just walking past and there's just the door. And I've got my microphone on my lapel, so, you know, which I hadn't even thought about. At this point, I'm just thinking, like, I need to get out of here. I'm scared. I forgot about the film. I'm that scared. And he just comes all close to me like he's in a mafia kind of thing. He's obviously watched all the movies, and he had about four or five people in there as well. And he just goes, why have you been telling people, right, and asking people about my relationship with Paola? And my heart just went like, oh God. And I realized all the other people in the room had told him I'd been asking. And then this journalist, I said, like, I haven't. I just asked some questions. It's normal for a journalist to ask these. Of course, I've got to ask, you know, how long has she been here and stuff like that. And at that point, this guy, Marco, the journalist, comes forward from sort of the shadows of this small, dank room. And he says, yeah, you asked me. And I said, no, I didn't. And he said, yeah, you did. You said, why do they always kiss each other on the mouth? And I said, I promise. And I'm looking at the exorcist. I'm going, I promise I did not ask that, because I didn't. And I'm saying to him, I can show you the video of our interview with him, because we only interviewed Marco about 10 minutes ago. We've got it all on video and you can watch it back. I didn't mention Paola in that way. And I certainly didn't ask about mouth kisses. And he goes, yes, you did. The exorcist is screaming at me. And I think they're gonna kill me. What was interesting as well was that he didn't at any point deny this accusation of the mouth kisses. It felt like it was something the journalist Marco had seen himself. And we ended up in a sort of getting as close to a physical scuffle as you can get without actual any physicality, screaming for an hour. Meanwhile, I can hear the Exorcist movie music booming through the walls, because just next door in the church, in next door, he's got 10,000 people spilling out onto the streets. There is like cordoned off roads and streets because this is such a big event. And they are like frothing at the mouth, these guys, because they're having to wait an hour. They don't know where the exorcist is. Well, he's backstage with me screaming at me. His spit is landing on me. He's right in my face. So then this, you know, this 18-year-old or 19-year-old with us, Demian, he tries to open the door. He's Argentine, you know, Argentinian. And he tries to open the door at one point, and the exorcist slams it shut on him. And he's screaming, this is my church. I'm a bishop. You need to respect me. And it's all complete nonsense. He's not a bishop. Like, it felt like he was adding things. Now you're a bishop as well? Like, you know. So eventually we did get outside. In all of this, some of the clergy are just trying to sort of calm things down. And they're saying, look, you're being filmed, to the exorcist. They're like, you're on film, mate. You're on film. Stop it. And he's like, I don't care. Let them film it. And some of them are saying to me, and they're just saying like, look, the mouth kisses. He does it to everyone. It's a normal thing. Which confirmed to me that he is at least kissing Paola on the mouth and all that kind of thing. Eventually we managed. He was just like screaming, and he just goes, I've got a mass to attend to. And he runs out the room with his sort of cape flying everywhere. And he goes and does his mass. And David and I are like, we got to get out of here. We try and get out, but like, and at this point, my legs are jelly, because I'm not used to this kind of thing. I think you're probably more used to this. You know, you've been in difficult situations. I've just not had anything like that. So my legs are just, I can hardly move. I'm shaking. I've forgotten about the film at this point. We've got the camera and everything. And now we have to get out of the church. The church is packed. You can't even breathe for people. It's like heaving. The walls are moving. So we're climbing over bodies of people. While the Exorcist music is getting more and more intense in the other room, you can see that he's now arrived on stage. They're all screaming and stuff. We're in the corridor next door, so we can see a bit of him on stage through the doors. And people are on the floor, foaming at the mouth, or falling on top of each other, and we're climbing over them. People are looking at us funny, like, who are those guys? And the priest is on the stage, and he's saying, the devil is in the house tonight, and we need to expel him. The devil has come in the form of these foreigners, and all this stuff. And we're like, no, oh God, hopefully no one realizes. And we climb over everyone, we get out onto the street, thinking, I don't even know, even then we're bustling past people, they're all collapsing everywhere, and we finally sort of stumble onto a road somewhere, like a back alley at 1 a.m. in the middle, just a dirt road, you know, middle of nowhere. And David says, I had the cap on the camera because he filmed me leave. And he said, we've got to get you leaving. And I said, I know, but we're not going back in there. And he said, we are going to have to go back in. And I was like, what do you mean? We're not going back in. We can just say, like, okay, it was a big argument and then it ended there. And we're having this. So David and I are now having this argument at 1 a.m. You know how directors are. He's like, he's got to get the shot. And he's going, we're going to have to go back in. So we go back to the church, climb over everybody to come back inside, hoping just please the exorcist won't see us. Please don't let him see us. Climb over everyone, go back to the room where he was shouting at us a minute ago. And then he films again of me leaving and walking out of that room, climbing over all the bodies again and getting out of there by the skin of our teeth. Everyone looking at us like, who are these guys? And we walked and walked and walked with all our expensive equipment in the dangerous suburbs of Buenos Aires, and eventually found a cab, which again, you just can't trust these guys. What had been happening was we were getting the church in our previous times to call a taxi company we knew in the center of Buenos Aires to come and get us. Or if it was in the middle of the day, we took a train back to the city. But this was the only time we were there that late. We got a taxi and we were just thinking, please don't, you know, see all of our expensive equipment and kill us or whatever. But it was only on the way back in that taxi, David and I looked at each other and thought, you know what? Like, that was all recorded, wasn't it? Like, my microphone was on. And we thought, you know, we've actually got something pretty extraordinary here. We've got a film. And we were there by that point, still scared, but laughing, and just a mad night. That was it.
That is an absolutely bone chilling experience. And I just, number one, I can't believe that you went back in just so you could get the film. So tell David that on the risk continuum, he blew it out of the water. But thank you so much for sharing that. I want to take a moment, and our time is up, but I want to take a moment and talk about your podcast, On the Edge with Andrew Gold. What's it about, and where can folks get it?
Oh, yeah. So this was it. I mean, it just became, after the Exorcist film, I made one or two other films of, you know, extreme beliefs, ideologies and stuff. It became so difficult to make those films and to get them commissioned. And I thought, you know what, I've got a list of all these people. So like somebody who just left the Westboro Baptist Church, and an ex-Jehovah's Witness, and somebody who was extremely political, either very far right or very far left or whatever. All these people who I saw as ideological, who I had wanted to make films about. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to do it on my camera, like what you're doing, Mike, and talk with people. So there's 3 episodes a week now. It's big on audio. I've now got it on YouTube as well. The last year, I'm trying to grow that channel. It's happening quite slowly, but compared to the audio podcast anyway. And most of it is dealing with people who have gone ideologically, either, you know, very far, either religiously or politically or whatever it might be. And then every now and then there'll be just, you know, Richard Dawkins was on there, or comedians, or there was a guy who had to eat his friends, for example, because he landed in the Andes, crash landed, and he had to survive by eating his friends. So sometimes just people who've just done extraordinary things come on as well.
Well, you're an incredible interviewer, and I really hope folks will dial into that. So folks, first assignment, you got to look down below in the description area. You'll see the links. Make sure you're going to your favorite podcast platform and signing up for On the Edge with Andrew Gold. But I also want to mention the fact that you got a new book that's coming out called The Psychology of Secrets. And just tell us how far out till that's due. And when it comes out, we got to make sure we get you on. And one night we'll go live or something for a few minutes just to push that as well. But tell me about that.
I'm going to love that. It's my first book. It's with a publishing company called Macmillan, and it's going to be out early 2024, which is an age away. So I might try and get them to push it forward if they can. It's the working title, The Psychology of Secrets. I found that doing the podcast, particularly the audio one, a lot of people got in touch and started to, I suppose, they started to trust me with their secrets. I didn't always ask for them. People would just get in touch and say, hello, Andrew, I like your podcast. My first memory was when my grandfather did this to me when I was 4 years old. And I'd be like, oh, thank you. Nice to meet you. Thanks for telling me that. One person told me that, a woman, that she killed a guy. So when that happened, it was like, okay, I've got a story here. And I looked at a lot of the people I've investigated over the years, and some of them have been like, you know, I hesitate to say the word because it's a YouTube thing, although you can edit it out actually, but the people who, I know on YouTube things get blocked and demonetized, but those people who are attracted to young, you know, underage people, I've investigated it, like those people in Germany, for example. I've investigated psychopaths and all these kinds of people who are all keeping secrets and living with secrets. So I thought, wouldn't it be fascinating to find out why we keep secrets, why we reveal them, why some of us reveal secrets more, some of us are better at keeping secrets, and what it's like, what it does to us physically and emotionally to keep secrets. If you keep too many secrets, there are links to very physical and real illnesses, a little bit like what we were talking about with the placebo effect and that kind of thing. So it's a book all about some of the craziest, wackiest people that I've met and investigated, but also looking at the nature of secrecy.
Now, as you explore that, will you do a favor for me and maybe one day report back? Because I spend a career with clearances and other things keeping secrets. And I want to know, after you've had a chance to explore this a little further, because I've already developed some opinions, is there a difference in the weight of those secrets when it is something that is done for noble reasons versus things that are done out of guilt? And I'll have you come back sometime and maybe share.
I've already got an answer for that.
Oh, please give it to me.
So a huge thing with the secret, one of the reasons it's so difficult to keep secrets is the shame involved in it. So we already know the types of secrets that are the hardest to keep are ones involving your identity. That's one of them. So for example, if you think of Alan Turing, who was gay and he had to hide that he was gay, the code breaker back in the war, that kind of thing is awful because it's your identity you're having to keep secret. It's the same with those people I mentioned who are attracted to under 18s or whatever. They're, you know, and I'm not saying feel sorry for them. I'm not judging. It's nothing to do with that, but that is a very, very difficult secret to keep, because it's also a secret that will ostracize you from your community. One type of secret that doesn't have any ramifications apparently to your physical and mental health is keeping surprises secret, because there's no guilt involved in it. So you've got to keep secret that you're going to propose to your wife, that you're going to do a surprise birthday. That's not going to give you that kind of guilt or shame. So we can surmise that if you're keeping secrets for good and valid reasons, that's not going to affect you, because it's not going to make you feel anything bad about your identity and your self-worth. It's not going to get you ostracized by your community if it were to come out. These are secrets that you're keeping for good reasons. So there's very little reason to believe that that would have any negative effects on your health. I think I'm going to say that that's fine. The difficulty is secrets on behalf of others, which I'm sure you will have had to have kept. There is a burden on that because you have that stress of having to make sure it doesn't come out. And if it does, you know, it's going to implicate somebody else. So when you reveal a secret to someone else, you have to consider how that person's now going to have to, you know, share some of your burden. So you might have some of that burden, but I think overall you're going to be pretty fine.
Well, folks, I want to thank Andrew Gold for coming on today's podcast. I hope you're going to check out his podcast and his book when it comes out in 2024, but we're going to make sure the podcast link is down below and also the link to your YouTube channel, Andrew. So thank you so much for taking time. I want to just ask, do you have anything you'd like to end with?
Oh, no, it was just such a pleasure coming on here. You're a fantastic interviewer, really, really good. From one interview to another, I really, really appreciate the work you do. Please, everyone, come. If you do come to my YouTube channel, because this is mostly, do you get more people on YouTube on this? If you comment and stuff, tell me that you came from Mike's channel, because I always like that. And I'll probably tell Mike, like, oh, it's great, all these people are coming from your channel and stuff. It's a nice way to just be in touch and stuff. So yeah, do let me know. And yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure, Mike. I'm so happy that we've done this.
Oh, it's been great. Well, you know, these discussions can be really disturbing for people. And I guess I just want to leave a message to everybody that, folks, if you know somebody who is being victimized by destructive kinds of behaviors, or if you yourself are being victimized, get help immediately. I do not believe that these things get better on their own. And there are resources and experts out there who spend their time helping people that are in cults, or people going through domestic violence, or people getting bullied at school. So, you know, even if you're watching a loved one or you're going through it yourself, get the help you need. I'm going to be watching for your comments down below on this episode, and I hope that you'll weigh in with your thoughts, your feelings, and your emotions. Make sure you're taking time to review the comments of other people and that you're learning from each other as we go through this process. And of course, if you like the episode, please hit the like and subscribe button and share our channel in your personal networks. Remember that you can subscribe to Profiling Evil podcasts on your favorite podcast platform. And for those of you who might be interested in supporting our efforts a little bit further, consider joining our channel memberships. You can get into these things for as little as $1.99 a month, and your contribution really does help. Now, I hope you'll check out the Academy level. It's my personal favorite. It opens the door to learning more about the investigative and the criminal profiling process, and you'll find those links below. And follow us on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. So, Andrew, thanks again, and to all of you, thanks for your support. We'll see you all soon at the next crime scene. Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is TruthFinder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give TruthFinder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time.